letter asking him to push for federal permission. A federal ban has been in place for nearly 3 decades, but record oil and gas prices have focused more attention on lifting the ban. In April, one of the conservation groups that formed after the 1969 spill, Get Oil Out, agreed not to oppose drilling in exchange for money, land, and a promise that drilling would end in 14 years. For NPR News, I'm Steve Julian in Los Angeles.
The government says orders for expensive and long-lasting goods increased in July. The Commerce Department says the increase in durable goods rose 1.3% last month. Durable goods are manufactured items like cars and computers. This increase is the second monthly increase in a row. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from sitforless.com, supporting NPR for 5 years and introducing the Zodi office chair by Hayworth, online at sitforless.com.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future environment. It is part of what makes a Subaru. Information online at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910. WILL programming is made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store, featuring locally grown and organic produce, freshly baked breads, a coffee bar, and bulk foods department. Strawberry Fields also offers natural vitamins, health and beauty products, household cleaning products, pet foods, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating.
Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Freinas at the controls this morning. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about recent events in Pakistan and India. Last week, facing the threat of impeachment, Pervez Musharraf stepped down as the president of Pakistan. It appeared that the opposition to Musharraf was the one thing that Pakistan's governing coalition could agree on. They seemed divided on almost everything else, and that certainly raises some serious questions about the country's future stability, or at least what's likely to happen next. So this morning we'll try to talk a little bit about the recent events, primarily in Pakistan, but also we'll be talking about India, and it seems difficult sometimes to talk about those two countries separately. And our guest for the program is someone who has been following politics in Pakistan and India for a long time, Stephen Cohen. He is at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., where he works on both India, Pakistan, and South Asian security issues. He was, for many years, here at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, professor of political science and history. He's also the founder and director of the program in arms control, disarmament, and international security. And he's talking with us from Brookings in Washington. We're pleased that he could be with us once again. And as we talk, questions from listeners are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask is that people try to keep their comments brief so that we can get in as many as possible and keep moving. But anyone who is interested is welcome to call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, your questions are welcome. Well, Stephen Cohen, hello.
Good morning, David. Glad to be back with you in Urbana, if even by electronic means.
Well, we're certainly very pleased that we could talk with you once again and that we have this high-quality connection. It may well sound to people as if you were here sitting next to me, but in fact, I am in Urbana and Steve is in Washington, D.C. To begin with, I suppose the thing to start with is the most recent big news from Pakistan, and that was last Monday when Pervez Musharraf announced that he would resign under pressure from the coalition of parties that are his opponents, divided among themselves. We can talk about that, but just as a way of starting, give you the chance to talk about the Musharraf resignation and just how significant that is.
Well, it came as a surprise to me, although everybody had been talking about this happening soon. I was in Pakistan. I've been in Pakistan for the past couple of weeks, and so I watched the resignation speech on television in the hotel lobby. And it turns out it was very similar, reminded me very much of the resignation speech I saw Richard Nixon give when he left, when he resigned the presidency. And it was a mixture of unhappiness, anger, resentment, but resignation also, that the inevitable was there and that Musharraf had to leave. The politicians had closed off every option for him. both in terms of public opinion, in terms of firming agreement up with outside countries that were supporting Pakistan. So I think he finally was told, you know, sir, you have no other alternative. Please go quietly. Otherwise, we're going to have to actually push ahead with an impeachment for him.
Well, there would have been a time where there would have been some support for him. And it seems that even people previously who had supported him, that support, support from the military and from within his own party, just it seemed to erode, and that it happened relatively quickly. What happened to undercut what support he would have, you know, maybe as much as a year ago he would have had?
Well, what happened was a series of, I think, incredibly stupid mistakes on his part. There was a lawyer's protest. He dismissed the judges. He did a lot of things which a lot of Pakistanis weren't happy with. Ironically, a lot of the support for Musharraf came from people who thought he had been a fairly good leader compared with what had come before and perhaps with what comes after. And what he did allow, and you can't fault him for what some of the things he did allow. He allowed a free press to go, in a sense, the free press that he allowed to function, or more or less free press, one of the things that actually got to him in the end, because quite struck this trip to Pakistan. I hadn't been there for a year and then hadn't been there before that for another year, was the power of public opinion and the media in Pakistan. All the politicians I met, all the military people I talked to, were either watching television or were on television. And it seems that TV, when there are, I think, 6 or 8 or maybe even more private channels in Pakistan, really is very powerful in the country. When you don't have and newspapers are also, in a sense, newspapers are now freely circulated, relatively uncensored, and I think that was one of the things that did him in. He's a man who was not an evil man, in a sense. He was not a malign person, and he meant well for Pakistan, but I don't think he had a political sense, a political touch, and eventually that's what got to him.
What will happen to him now?
Probably stay in Pakistan for a brief period and then maybe move overseas. There was some expectation on his part, according to everybody who talked to him recently, that if he hung around for a couple of weeks or even a couple of months, the politicians would collapse and somebody might call him back to power. And that may still happen, conceivably. And if Zardari and the Pakistan People's Party make a big mess of things, then Musharraf is there standing in the wings. But I doubt very much whether people want to see another Musharraf government. He was, in the end, in over his head. He was a guy who really did not have the political or, I think, intellectual qualities to run a country like Pakistan. Hmm. But more seriously, the question is whether anybody can run Pakistan or whether any political party can run Pakistan. I have doubts about that, and I think it's a graver problem than simply the fate of one individual.
Hmm. Since last winter, there has been a coalition government, 4 parties. The 2 biggest ones are the Pakistan People's Party. This was the party of Benazir Bhutto, and
right,
now
right.
It's the party of her widower. And then there's a party of another former prime minister, Nawaz Sharif. He was the guy who was pushed aside in 1999 when Musharraf took over.
Right, right.
And the 2 of them have different agendas. And in fact, just within, I think, the last couple of days, Nawaz Sharif's party actually pulled out of the coalition. So here one wonders, how exactly is this all going to get worked out?
Well, I left Pakistan Friday night, Saturday morning. And since I've gone, several major things have happened. This is a country where important events are happening on a daily basis, almost an hourly basis. Maybe that's why one reason people are watching so much television. The Pakistan People's Party pulled out. The deal sort of collapsed. Zardari is going to nominate himself or be nominated to be president of Pakistan. Nobody knows the terms under which he would become president, whether or not he'll continue to hold power in the Pakistan People's Party itself, whether he'd be party chief as well as president of Pakistan. So things are happening at a very fast rate. I wouldn't agree that the 2 parties differ that much. In your introduction, you said that they're very different. The Pakistan People's Party and the Pakistan Muslim League of Nawaz Sharif. I think both are fundamentally secular, or that is, non-religious in their orientation. I'd say, and both want normal relations with India. Benazir was one of those who advocated that very strongly, and Nawaz was in part dumped by the military because he favored close ties with India, certainly trade ties with India. So I think that the difference between the parties might be comparable to the difference between Republicans and Democrats here. Of course, the structure of the parties are quite different than American political parties. They don't have very deep grassroots, except for the Pakistan People's Party, which is the only organized political party in Pakistan that reaches more than one province. It's strong in two provinces at least.
The expectation is now that Asif Ali Zardari is going to stand for president in these elections in September?
Apparently so. I met him the day before the announcement was made that the party might nominate him. He didn't let on a peep to me as to what his plans were. So I think that he probably will become president. The question is what kind of powers he has as president, whether he wants to retain the power to dismiss an elected government or whether he'd give that up. And I'm not quite sure which direction he's going to move. Mm. And also, I don't know that much about his personality. There was a big report in the Financial Times 2 days ago, and it was republished today in the New York Times, that he had some mental problems. And what I think this was largely the report of a psychiatrist who had looked at him and found that he had impaired judgment and the onset of dementia. I talked to him for 2.5 hours, and this is not a guy who's crazy. If he's crazy, he's crazy like a fox. I'm sure that was an act that he put on. And certainly when Benazir was murdered, he held the party together. He behaved very coolly. You know, he's performed very well politically over the past couple of months since her assassination. I'm not sure what's going to happen even tomorrow. I mean, it's a very unpredictable, fluid situation.
Mm. That was certainly – I was interested in your reaction to that story because as I read it as well, it also talked about – and I suppose you would understand it, having had lost his wife to an assassination, that he would – he would be troubled to say the least, but I guess I wondered, well, what does that mean, and is it true, is it not, and whose interests get served by having a story like this out there?
I'm not sure who leaked it. That's a good question. I suspect the Pakistan Muslim League might have leaked it, or maybe one of Musharraf's former officials leaked it, certainly designed to embarrass him. Or maybe somebody just went to the courts and dug it out because it might have been part of the British legal record. I'm just not sure how and why that was leaked. Mm-hmm. But I certainly think it's certainly not true. He's a very clever guy. He's actually a very intelligent man, very widely read, knows a lot about a lot of things. Whether he's got the kind of personality that's stable and democratic or committed to a normal Pakistan in the long run, I don't know. In Pakistan, you know, he could turn out to be a demagogue as his father-in-law was, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto.
I take your point that the situation is so fluid it's difficult to predict what will happen. But having said that, what do you think that Nawaz Sharif is going to do now?
Well, he's been outfoxed twice. And first he was lured into a coalition with Zardari to get rid of Musharraf. Now he himself is out of the coalition in a position of opposition. And I don't know whether he's going to go to the streets. His party controls the Punjab, his brother's chief minister of Punjab. But I'm not sure what his next step is. Maybe to sit back as an opposition leader and let the Pakistan People's Party and Zardari make a mistake and then try and force new elections. Maybe to agitate in the streets. It's not quite clear what's going to happen, but this is going to continue to be an exciting year for Pakistan. It's a country that's been in a crisis for several years, and this crisis is going to be prolonged into the future. In my book, I argued that after Musharraf, you'd get a regime that would come to power. And if that failed, then all bets are off for the future of Pakistan. And I still think that's true. If this government fails and if it can't manage, govern properly, and they haven't been doing any governing for the past couple of weeks, then the future of Pakistan is very much in doubt.
Our guest this morning, Stephen Cohen. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. His area of expertise, the politics of India and Pakistan. He was for many years here, professor of political science at the U of I, was the founder of the program in arms control, disarmament, and international security. And it's good enough occasionally to talk with us about India and Pakistan. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. It seems that one issue that certainly did divide these two parties was the how to respond to the sacking of these judges by former president Mr. Musharraf, and it seemed that Mr. Zardari was not exactly sure about how to deal with this, but Nawaz Sharif and his party were solidly behind the idea that these people should be reinstated as soon as possible. What exactly is that issue about, and is that a significant difference between the two parties and how they think it ought to be resolved?
It's not a difference of principle. It's a difference of pragmatic judgment about what the judges would do if they were reinstated. Pakistan has had some very activist judges. These judges were holding office hours or holding court after the court had closed and determining things on their own. It was a very unusual situation for Pakistan, especially since some of the judges that were doing this were not noted for their previous judicial probity. And in one case, it appears that they were going to find Zardari guilty of several crimes. His defense is that he's never been found guilty of any crime, even though he's been kept in prison for 8 years. So I think that one of the aspects of the deal that they worked out was that the judges would sort of disappear. Zardari would come to power or play some role in Pakistan, and the cases against him would be dismissed. Now, Nawaz wants to restore the judges because he wants to nail Zardari. It comes down to that. Nawaz himself is no great friend of the judiciary. In fact, he helped invade and destroy the judiciary. That was one of the reasons why Musharraf overthrew him. So I think that it's really a struggle for power and protection against the judiciary, which is in some ways out of control. I mean, you talk about activist judges. The Pakistani judges were deciding on their own, individually, the Chief Justice, what he would do and the results he would produce. I think that one of the questions facing Pakistan is how to have a balance of power between the judiciary, the executive, and the legislature. And they haven't quite worked that out. And this is purely a struggle for power, not a principle. I've advised my Pakistani friends to go and read the Federalist Papers. You know, the one original contribution of the United States to governance was checks and balances. And while they've talked about it, I don't think they really understand the need to have systematic, organized checks and balances on centers of power. So I think that that's a big open question for Pakistan.
Both of these men, Asif Ali Zardari and Nawaz Sharif, have been accused of corruption. How do Pakistani, the people feel about them, you know, the possibility of Mr. Zardari being the president, and both of them continue to be important figures and movers and shakers in politics of Pakistan.
You know, Zardari's defense is that he's never been found guilty of anything. Maybe that's one reason he wants to make sure the judges are not restored. Nawaz's case, more ambivalent in terms of what he did and what others have done. There's probably not a single Pakistani figure of any consequence that hasn't been accused of corruption, and it's just assumed that everybody's corrupt to a certain degree. Pakistan is regarded by Transparency International as one of the most corrupt countries in the world, and that has not changed in the past 15 or 20 years. Even under the military, it was still regarded as a corrupt country and very difficult to do business in. So, I think Pakistanis, you talk to Pakistanis, businessmen and students and professors and journalists and so forth, they're very cynical towards their government. They really feel very bitter, let down. They're unhappy with the military because they weren't that effective. In a sense, it's a country that of almost 180 million people, very frustrated, looking for some kind of honest, straight leadership, but they're not going to get it, or they're not going to get it soon, I'm afraid.
We have a couple of callers here. Someone in Urbana here to start with where we are. This is line number one.
Oh, hi, Hello? Dr. Cohn. I think we had a mutual friend, Art Silliman. I think you lived next to him when you were
Certainly, sure.
Yes,
sure,
yes.
Sure.
I met you once a couple times. I really appreciate your work. I was curious about recently in the New York Times there was a detailed article about a Swiss family that was they were traders and they would work with the Khan network, and the Swiss government supposedly destroyed all these documents because they were tied to the CIA or something. I don't even know much about that, but you were mentioning earlier about Pakistan disintegrating. Or falling apart. Do you mean politically falling apart or socially falling apart or breaking up into, you know, like Waziristan and the border states? And I'm not sure. What do you mean by that?
Keep on going. Keep on going. You know, there may be
reason I ask is because I'm worried about the nuclear weapons there. I mean, I'm sure the U.S. government knows where they're at. But I'm worried about India seeing Pakistan go radical, you know, like Taliban-like, and then and having this huge war and killing millions of people. And I'm wondering if that's in your agenda, or if you've thought about that, or do the people there worry about that, or does the government worry about that? Does anybody care? I'm just curious if you know, sir. Thank you.
Oh, it's on my agenda as a scholar. It's on, I think, Pakistani agenda. It's certainly on Congress's agenda. I testified before the Senate a couple of weeks ago, and I got some follow-up questions from several senators on this question in particular. Who's got the nukes? Are they under safe control? Mm-hmm. Could they be lost? Could somebody capture them? And the answer to all of that is I'm not quite sure. And even the Pakistanis I talked to the military element in general headquarters that's responsible for nuclear weapons. Spent a day with them there, and they're very defensive and they talk a good talk. They're the only ones that actually provide information about the security of the nuclear weapons, so you don't quite know whether to trust them or not, because it's obviously in their interest to claim that they have a flawless security system. So I think there are concerns.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say that right now there's a concern, in a sense the weapons are under the control of the military, but if Pakistan should begin to come apart at the seams, and this is a scenario I actually talk about it in my Pakistan book, physically, intellectually, politically, militarily, there should be another war with India. Things turn out badly. Then you'd wonder who's going to control those nuclear weapons, both their use and also their theft and potential giving them away to terrorist groups and so forth. There's no evidence that I know of, that I've heard of, that the weapons are vulnerable now. But again, if you get a country that's on the verge of breaking up, as the Soviet Union did a number of years ago, then you focus on those things very carefully. And in this case, the weapons appear to be concentrated in one or two provinces and under tight military control. But if you get a civil war in Pakistan or a series of breakaway movements which stress the army, then you just don't know exactly what's going to happen to those weapons. In the worst scenario, you could get an army commander, a corps commander, who had physical control over the weapons. He decided that he was going to beat up on the Indians or punish the United States by allowing some radical Islamist group to seize them and actually use them. That'd be the very worst case. Or another scenario would be that within the organization that protects the weapons, there could be infiltration of some kind of Islamist extremist. They would steal them. There are other scenarios also. I think more likely is that if the Iranians go nuclear in the future, and it certainly appears that they're headed that direction, then Saudi Arabia will definitely want nuclear weapons. And the one country they would probably turn to for a nuclear umbrella or actually physical possession of nuclear weapons would be Pakistan. So I think this kind of loss of control or spread of nuclear weapons could happen in a number of different ways. Pakistan is sort of the epicenter of this problem. But nobody worries about it because there are so many other pressing problems.
Yeah.
The terrorist problem is enormous in Pakistan. I was in 4 cities that were 5 major bomb blasts as I traveled around Pakistan. Not directed against me, but
yeah,
just yesterday, a friend of mine was in the U.S. Consul General in Peshawar. You know, she drove out of her house. She was machine gunned by her car was machine gunned by some guys who tried to waylay her. So I think that people aren't worried about the nuclear weapons. There's more pressing problems and urgent problems.
Before I let you go, just one other question: the ISI, the Pakistani intelligence, I mean, they work for the CIA and everybody knows everybody. But how, I mean, it seems so interesting to me that when you read, I mean, they're making novels out of this stuff. But how corrupt are they and how reliable are they? Because I know that there's that whole shadow government by them, from what I've read. And I've actually read some of your stuff, and really your scholarship is impeccable. But I'm just wondering if you could talk about that, and I'll let you go. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no. Also, I want to make a comment on in the India question, which you asked. I'd say that the ISI is still a very mysterious organization, even to those Pakistanis who purport to control it. It's not quite clear, you know, how much control anybody has over the organization. I've heard from ISI people that we're professional. We do what we're told to do. We don't do things we're not told to do. But then you have these actions, such as the attack on the Indian embassy in Kabul, which was an astonishing act and could only have been done. And apparently, Pakistanis did it. So the U.S. government said they did it. And you know, why did they do that? You know, were they trying to foment a crisis between India and Pakistan? Were they trying to demonstrate to the Pakistani government that they still have a lot of influence? Was it an accident? You know, was it a rogue ISI element? Nobody knows nobody has a good answer to these questions. And it's very troublesome that you have a large, powerful organization busy actively trying to subvert India. That's its major role, but also playing a domestic political role. control in Pakistan. And, you know, that's all I can say about it. You know, in a sense, we don't know what we don't know, and what we do know is very troublesome. And I'd also, you know, asked about India. I'd also point out that while I was in Pakistan for the past couple of weeks, India appears to have lost control again over big chunks of Kashmir. There have been massive public protests in Kashmir directed against the Indian government. While some of this may be fomented or supported from Pakistan, clearly, you know, this is a breakdown of Indian governance in Kashmir itself. And this is the kind of popular movement that we saw in 1989 that triggered a long period of guerrilla warfare in Pakistan, separatist sentiments in Kashmir. And this could be another crisis there. And during 1990, there was a crisis between India and Pakistan, and it grew in part out of weak governments in both India and Pakistan, and also a crisis in Kashmir. And that's what we see. That's what we're seeing right now. Weak government in India, weak government in Pakistan, a new crisis in Kashmir. I'm not saying history is going to repeat itself, but the potential for another India-Pakistan crisis is certainly there.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Stephen Cohen. He is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. His area of expertise is security and proliferation issues, particularly in South Asia. So we're talking about India and Pakistan. He's former professor of political science here at the U of I and also former director of the program in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security. If you're interested in reading some of his work, you can look for one or the other of his books. One is titled India Emergent Power, and the other is The Idea of Pakistan. So you can look for them in the library or in the bookstore. And questions here are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And next we'll talk with someone on our toll-free line, calling on cell phone. This is line 4. Hello.
Hi. I have some friends who work in Bangalore, and about 6 weeks ago, there were some bombings there, and I didn't know if the professor knew if that was going to affect U.S. business dealings in India.
I was in Bangalore just after another series of bombings. I don't think this is going to sharply affect American investment in Bangalore or operations in Bangalore. But it might lead some companies to sort of spread their risks around India or even other countries. Certainly not pleasant when your citizens or your employees are subjected to terrorist bombings. Now, the bombings weren't necessarily directed against Americans, and they weren't necessarily directed against, as I recall, they weren't directed against Indian software industry, but they did take place in Bangalore, which is the, right, you know, the poster child for Indian high-tech development. But there are other Indian cities which have been more placid, more calm. My guess is that the Indian firms themselves don't regard the risk as that great. But clearly this represents this is deeply troubling to Indian politicians and security people, because if it's Islamic in its origin, that is Indian Muslims doing it, this would represent part of the first sign of Indian Muslims themselves catching on to this global Islamic unhappiness. I won't be anything more specific about that. I think you know what I mean. In a sense that Indian Muslims themselves are losing faith in the Indian political system to protect them. Now, it's not quite clear that's what's happening, but this is a great concern in New Delhi and also in Bangalore Indian Muslims.
Do you know who performed? I mean, does anybody know?
Yeah, no. There's no clear. I think they've tracked down some of the bombings to particular individuals, mostly Indians, that is Indian Muslims, not to Pakistani agents coming over to India. And there's a concern that this is growing in the Indian Muslim community. But sir, if it is growing, it's growing very slowly. You know, I'd say that most Indian Muslims feel that their political grievances and concerns can be met by normal politics within the Indian political system. But clearly, there have been huge violations of crimes against Muslims committed in parts of India. And there is some deep Muslim resentment within India itself.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Okay. Back here to another caller, someone where we are here in Urbana. This is line 2. Hello.
Hello there. Mm-hmm. There was an election, and I believe it's Palestine, and I can't say the names because I get them all confused, 3 or 4, maybe 5 years ago, where the United States kind of basically ignored the results and said, no, this wasn't the right election. How much does that kind of stuff affect influence around the rest of the world, especially Pakistan, where they and where they can just take and kind of say, well, you know, we'll do our election the way we want to, kind of attitude?
Now, are you referring to Are you referring to an election in Palestine? Did I hear you right?
I'm not sure.
I think he was talking about when they had elections and Hamas. Won, and
when Hamas won, yeah.
And the administration, the Buddhist administration, was not particularly happy about that because that was not a group that they were into talking to.
Okay, yeah.
They kind of shut down all the programs they were doing together. So is what I remember. Is that kind of right? They quit. They wouldn't acknowledge it. Is what I'm thinking.
Yeah, I think what happened was that the Bush administration stressed the importance of free and fair elections. When there was a free and fair election, some people who were profoundly anti-American, like Hamas, got elected, also anti-Israeli.
Right.
And I think the Bush administration probably oversold the virtue of free elections in a sense that a free election that brings Adolf Hitler to power or Joseph Stalin to power or Hamas to power is not exactly an ideal election.
Do they see that stuff in India and Pakistan? Do they see that as an ad to them?
I think that one of the things that struck me in 2 weeks in Pakistan is not a single person asked me, and I was giving all kinds of TV and radio and public appearances, not a single person asked me about the Middle East. Previously, when I went to Pakistan, they were very sensitive to issues of American policy in the Middle East. Not a single question on that issue at all. So I think that they're more worried about their own problems, their own elections, and their own outcomes than they are about policy in the Middle East. Clearly, this is a grievance for most, say, Pakistanis in terms of an Islamic solidarity with Palestinians. But I think they're far more worried about what's happening in their own country. In the case of India, I think the Indian government has never taken democracy seriously outside of India. They've always been cool towards democracies or democratic movements. When there's a dictator or dictatorship or one-party state they can play ball with, they don't mind doing that at all. So from an Indian point of view, what happened in the Middle East is, in terms of elections, probably irrelevant. They've got good relations with Israel. They've got good relations with the Palestinians. As a matter of policy, they've simply not supported democratic forces when it's been inconvenient for them to do that. You see that in the case of Burma, and you see that in the case of Georgia, probably, and in other areas also. So Indians simply didn't care about that.
Thank you.
No, thank you. Obviously, the United States is very concerned about Pakistan. It's concerned about the possibility and limiting the possibility of conflict between Pakistan and India. And then for a long time, Pakistan has been important to the United States in its policy in Afghanistan. And now, recently, in the effort to go after al-Qaeda, and then before that, in the assistance that we provided to the freedom fighters who were fighting against the Soviets when they were there. So Pakistan's very important to the United States. Having said all that, also the United States, I'm sure, doesn't want it to appear that they're trying to influence politics in Pakistan. But what are the interests of the United States, and is there some way that they can, in fact, intervene in a way that wouldn't be really obvious but would satisfy whatever interests we have?
Well, David, I don't think you should be so shy about this. We've intervened in Pakistan massively, and obviously, and there's no question that the U.S. has a vital stake in the outcomes in Pakistan. I'd say that's true of the Chinese. It's true of the Saudis also. Saudi Arabia played a major role in Nawaz Sharif's comeback in politics, and the Chinese have been consistent supporter of the Pakistan government and whoever's in charge in Pakistan, whether it's the military or now the civilians. So I think that America plays a role there. The British also play a role there. We meddle in their politics, but again, we have a lot at stake there. In a sense, I'm glad we're meddling on the side of democracy in Pakistan. Benazir used to say that we meddled in Pakistani politics for decades by supporting military dictatorships, and now if we meddle to support a more stable democratic system, I think that's perfectly legitimate and something we shouldn't be ashamed about. Mm-hmm. I know, in fact, that the U.S. was involved in brokering this deal to get Musharraf out of power. We were regarded as his best foreign friend, and in a sense, we made no special effort to ensure that he stayed in power. That was a green light for the Pakistani politicians to dump him, which they cheerfully did. I think that let me go back for a second and advise your readers to look at a book that covers the Pakistan-Afghanistan thing very well. Is a book by Ahmed Rashid, and it's called Descent into Chaos. It's a long book. It's very long, but it's very well written. And Ahmed was the key guy to first explain the Taliban to us. He wrote a book called The Taliban. He's a Pakistani journalist, fearless journalist, visits America regularly. And so Descent into Chaos by Ahmed Rashid, it's probably too long a book, but dipping into it, you get a great background into exactly what's going on between Pakistan and Afghanistan. Afghanistan. He's very pessimistic about the future, and I sort of share his concern about what's happening in both Afghanistan and Pakistan.
One other thing, I'm interested in what you make of this story now that has just come out concerning Zalmay Khalilzad, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., who perhaps has been doing a little freelancing work, at least offering some advice to Asif Ali Zardari. Apparently the administration has said no, they don't, or at least they're saying, no, he shouldn't be doing this. He wasn't doing this at our request. We weren't directing this. And I suppose at least publicly the government doesn't want to make it look like they're endorsing Mr. Zardari. What do you make of all of that?
I heard about that from Asif Zardari himself. I saw him, this is Wednesday. I saw him a week ago. And he said, I'm going to meet Zalmay in Dubai, I think. And I said, well, Zal's an old friend of mine. I give him my best regards when you see him. Hadn't occurred to me that Zalmay was meeting him probably against the wishes or doing this on his own without the State Department's approval. But I don't know the details of this. But frankly, I think the U.S. government has botched its Pakistan policy. Zalmay knows a lot about Pakistan. If I had to choose between Zalmay's policy and the U.S. government's policy, I'd probably choose Zalmay's. I think he's certainly more attuned to what's going on in the region and has followed Pakistan very carefully and closely for a long period of time. That doesn't mean he should, as a U.S. government official, he should be freelancing and conducting his own foreign policy. But he's close to Bush. He was one of the original Vulcans. He probably figures that he can get away with it and maybe do something useful in the case of Pakistan and Afghanistan. Of course, Zalmay has also been rumored, and I'm not sure whether he's the one spreading the rumors or not, to be a candidate for the next president of Afghanistan. There's widespread unhappiness both in the United States and in Afghanistan and among the NATO powers that are in Afghanistan with President Karzai's performance as president. There's going to be a new election in Afghanistan for president, and there's great concern about whether Karzai has the ability to actually run the country properly. So I have no idea at all. I haven't talked to Khalilzad about this at all, whether Zalmay would actually run for president, but this has been rumored from several sources. And, of course, Zalmay was born in Afghanistan. He was originally an Afghan citizen.
All right. Let's take another caller here in Champaign County, here where we are. Line one. Hello.
Hi. I just did read Descent into Chaos, and I did learn a lot, but I also learned that I disagree with him a lot as well. And I think he'd left some things out, which I won't go into right now. But he was noted that he was in calling for the folding and military folding of the Taliban regime before 2001. So he's in a category of his own, it seems to me. But I wanted to ask about when the Prime Minister of Pakistan was visiting the White House, the Defense Department or someone remotely controlled a Predator missile, Predator, and sent a Hellfire missile into a place in Pakistan, and explicitly pointing out what the U.S. can do. That was commented on widely. Musharraf picked the time to have his regular Pakistani troops go over the line of control and fire in Kashmir, and it seemed to me that was also a message being sent, and it may have been his final undoing. I don't know how you would react to that. It seems to me that the dynamics of India, China, and Pakistan are not as widely commented on. Rashid does a little bit, but I'm actually looking forward to Tariq Ali's book on Pakistan, which is probably getting rewritten with an afterword now that Musharraf has been deleted from the scene. I'd like for you to read some of that.
Yeah, do me a favor and send me an email with your comments on Ahmad Rashid's book, because I haven't read it. I haven't read all of it myself. I read a chunk of it. I'm curious to see what you think is missing.
Well, the one thing was really astonishing. He had a most major blooper I've ever seen. He's sort of chiding NATO for not putting more effort and manpower into and having all of these caveats in the war in Afghanistan. And he cites that the Americans spend $562 billion on weaponry, and he adds up the 26 other NATO forces and says that they spend $262 million, where clearly he was trying to point out that they spend half as much in 23. But he actually had $262 million, which is wouldn't even cover 8 hours of British troops in Basra if they haven't pulled out yet.
Okay. I didn't read that part of the book, but generally, he's the most penetrating and knowledgeable journalist writing about these subjects. And of course, he was very critical of Taliban from the beginning. And I think had we followed Ahmed's advice, we would not have gone into Iraq until after we had made sure that Afghanistan was on a straight and narrow path. And I think that was one of the great tragedies of this administration, that they assumed that Afghanistan was easy and they turned their resources to Iraq, and that turned out to be difficult, and Afghanistan also turns out to be difficult. And I think Ahmed was one of the first people to point that out right from the very beginning. So I think he gets a lot of credit for that. But you may be, I'll certainly take a look at the book. Let me say that you talked about messages, whether the Pakistani, with the American predators and the Pakistani line of incursion were messages of some sort or another. I would caution I would advise great caution in that whole way of interpreting things. I finished a book about 2 years ago with an Indian and a Pakistani colleague of mine, and we looked at the four major crises between India and Pakistan, called four crises in a peace process. And Brookings published it, $29.99, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that one of the things we discovered was that there was a lot of misinformation floating around. Some of these affected the crises. That is, the press reports were often inaccurate, incomplete. Some were planted. You could rely on the press in many cases. And I know when I was in the government for 2 years working for George Shultz, I came to learn that half of what I read about anything interesting was wrong. And I thought I knew which was the right half and which was the wrong half on the basis of government information, classified material. But when I left the government, I didn't know which half was right and which half was wrong. So I think it's a pick-and-choose-it kind of process. You've got to use these newspaper sources very, very carefully. And most leaks are, in fact, motivated by one side or another side. So I'd be very careful. And say, in terms of Pakistani sending some forces over the line of control, well, if you read the Pakistani reports, I'm sure they said that the Indians sent forces over the line of control. In fact, both may be right or both may be wrong. So I'd be very careful in reading these newspaper reports and stringing them together some kind of coherent narrative. Often it's simply bumbling miscalculation, miscommunication. And that was the basis of all the crises we looked at. Every single crisis we looked at in India and Pakistan had a strong element of misperception and miscommunication in it, as well as misjudgment of intelligence data.
Well, on the subject of Kashmir, which has been one of the occasions for conflict between India and Pakistan, this long simmering conflict, very complicated because there are a number of different groups and people have different claims, and some people want to be part of India and some people want to be part of Pakistan and some people want to be independent, and there are interests of all of those parties and China in here. Is it likely that any time in the foreseeable future anything here significant is going to change, or could we be having the same conversation a year from now, 2 years from now?
David, it's going to change. It's going to get worse. I mean, that's how it's going to change. I don't see any. There's a marvelous set of public opinion polls done recently, published by the Pew people, and just released. And it turns out that Indian and Pakistani public opinion is not coherent on the subject of Kashmir. So the political possibility of either government making a move on Kashmir is very small. The role of the United States, I thought the U.S. could play a role, but public opinion in both countries sort of opposes the idea. And the situation on the ground in Kashmir is getting worse, not getting better. Kashmiris are very alienated. The Indians can't absorb them into the Indian Union properly. The Kashmiris don't want to go to Pakistan. They want independence, but that's ruled out by both India and Pakistan. I think Kashmir is a poster child for the fact that we're living in an era where nation states of the classic state, of classic kind, are simply obsolete. They don't work anymore. They don't work well anymore. We've seen the breakup of the Soviet Union, breakup of Yugoslavia. India and Pakistan both have, weakness on the edges. They're strong centers, but they're not that strong, and the loyalties on the provinces and in the fringes are very weak to the center. So I think that we're going to have to live with this for a long time. And when you get an Islamic extremist component to it, it gets very nasty. Then the great fear of the United States, I think, is that these places which are ungovernable, can't be controlled by anybody, will become the base for groups which try to attack us from a long distance, as Al-Qaeda was in Afghanistan.
Another caller here, Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hi, my name is Gary, And I wanted to ask Speaker about his comment a little while ago saying that both India and Pakistan have weak governments. And I thought India was quite stable at this time, considering its economic growth and everything. So could you please elaborate on that? I'll hang up and listen on the radio. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Oh, Gauri, I think it's stable in a sense that it's a functioning democracy that's gone through amazing transformations and adaptations and changes over the years. So it's stable, but it's not that strong. In a sense, in fact, the Indian economy grew when the government got weaker. That is, as the government stepped back and allowed businessmen and high-tech people to operate, the economy grew very quickly. In a sense, the state is strong in an area where it's dysfunctional. You know, British India was a state designed to control, not designed to grow economically or modernize. And Indian India, contemporary India, still is a weak state in terms of its control over its own territory. The Prime Minister has said, Manmohan Singh, who's a very admirable guy, a marvelous economist, has said that the greatest security threat to India is not from India or Pakistan, not from China, I'm sorry, China or Pakistan. I'm still jet-lagged from my trip. But internally, you know, they don't have control over something like 25% of their districts. That is a weak state, not a strong state, and they don't have the police or political power to establish control. And this is partly because India is undergoing several simultaneous cultural, social, economic revolutions. In a sense, there's a social turmoil in India, which is unsurpassed in modern history in terms of caste relations. There's a regional competition in India. There's an economic revolution going on, which creates stresses and strains in Indian society. So I'd say that given the turmoil that India is undergoing and the major changes you see, you know, day-to-day in India, the state is doing very well, but it's still a weak state. And certainly Pakistani state is extremely weak. Can't control like a third of the country.
There was a confidence vote this past summer back in July. I think Manmohan Singh called it himself. He won, but it was not it was a rather narrow victory.
Yeah, he was opposed by his own coalition partners on the U.S.-India nuclear deal. So he survived, but they have sabotaged all of his attempts to have major economic reform. And I think the reason for that is that Indian politics is becoming so decentralized. That is, the strong central parties, the BJP and the Congress Party, are getting weaker, and they can only govern by coalition. So even the Congress Party, which used to be the New York Yankees of India, you know, the dominant political power, they never had more than 50% of the vote. And now they have much less than that. They can only govern with the assistance of regional political parties who are not that interested in having a strong center in New Delhi. The regional political parties in India want a weak center. So in a sense, Congress can get by only by cooperating with parties that want a weak center, not a strong center.
And are we going to see sometime between now and next spring there'll be national elections?
Yeah, I think they have to be held before May, and you'll probably see. I wouldn't begin to predict the outcome, but I suspect if Congress or the BJP puts together a coalition, then they'll get elected. But they'll still have to govern with the consent of coalition partners. On the other hand, the chief minister of Uttar Pradesh, who's a remarkable woman, Mayawati. She has said that she wants to be prime minister. She would be the first untouchable scheduled caste politician to become prime minister of India. Be an amazing cultural social development, analogous to Barack Obama, even more remarkable than, say, Barack Obama becoming president in the United States. And that, I think, that would symbolize a major social revolution underway in India.
We have 3-4 minutes left. Speaking of Barack Obama, and we know the man who will be his challenger. When you look at anything that either of them, Senators McCain or Obama, has said about this part of the world, about India, Pakistan, about the relationship between the United States and those countries, is there anything that emerges that you think is significant, at least in that would say something to us about, if were they to be elected president, what sort of policy they would take?
For both of them, new factors, plural, are the emergence of major American investment in India and now Indian investment in the United States. So there's an economic ballast in the U.S.-India relationship, which is important. And secondly, both are pushing for Indian-American votes and also money. Indian Americans are one of the leading, you know, most prosperous of ethnic communities in the United States. I think both are trying to pitch for that support. But I would say something else that I think is very important. and I haven't seen much commented on. I think that the Russian invasion of Georgia is going to make India less important, or it's going to change our understanding of India. From my view, you're going to see an American calculation that the security and safety of Europe and NATO is more important to us than the threat of China, potential threat of China. So India's role in the world is seen largely in terms of a balancer of China, but it also has a historic relationship with Russia, and that could come back and haunt the Indians in a sense if the Indians themselves regard the Russian invasion of Georgia as legitimate, perfectly fine to break up a country on their border. I think, and NATO gets alarmed by that. I think then the Indian position is going to create, on that issue, is going to create stresses between the NATO countries and the United States in New Delhi. The NATO countries don't care about the rise of China. I think they're more worried about the resurgence of Russia. So India, in a sense, has to make a decision whether it regards the new Russian threat to Europe, if you want to call it a threat, the new Russian assertiveness vis-a-vis Europe, as more significant than the potential, threatening role of China in Asia. And that could change the balance of American policy towards India.
Hmm. Well, other than acknowledging that India is a significant economic power and that, the United States would want to have positive relations with India, what more would India be looking for from the United States?
I'm writing a book about that. Indians are primarily interested in terms of strategic things in military technology. They want to build their own armed forces up to a point where they're a significant military force. I think they're now concerned about our role in Pakistan in a new way. Before they were concerned about our support for Pakistan, now I think they would like to see us help stabilize Pakistan. And I think the Indians have to make important decisions about whether they want to tip Pakistan over the edge and destroy it, or whether they want to help save a Pakistan, at least in a weakened form. So I think the Indians themselves have a lot of, we're going to have a new relationship with India regarding Pakistan and potentially, of course, the old concern about a threatening rising China. India was seen as the balancer of that kind of China. But the Indians themselves, I think, have concluded that they can accommodate China. In fact, they're too weak militarily to challenge China. Over all of this is the shadow of nuclear weapons. So from an Indian point of view, if you're doing a strategic calculation vis-a-vis the rise of China or the failure of Pakistan, both of those countries are nuclear weapon states, and I think nuclear weapons sort of change the rules of international politics when in dealings between nuclear states with nuclear weapons.
And just a sort of a final thought, again, as a way of wrapping up, anything on the horizon you think that would significantly change the relationship between India and Pakistan?
No, I think that both Zardari and Nawaz Sharif very much would like to see normal economic ties with India. They need Indian investment. They'd like to see commerce and trade between the two countries. Indians are not that eager to do it. The Indians don't want to be dependent on Pakistan for this oil and gas pipeline. Indians are reluctant to get involved with this, although Indian business would like to invest in Pakistan. But again, it's the Pakistan army that's most suspicious of India. And I think until the army changes its view towards India, the politicians who want to normalize with India would benefit from normalization with India. I don't think they're going to get their way.
Our guest, Stephen Cohen, he is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. If you're interested in reading some of his work, you might look for his book, The Idea of Pakistan, or India Emergent Power.
Or on the Brookings website.
That was what I was going to suggest to folks, that there's much there in the way of research and commentary about this region on the Brookings website, which is brookings.edu. And Steve, thank you very much for talking with us today.
David. Delighted to be back in Urbana in my disembodied form, but best wishes to all my friends.
And we'd also like to say thanks to Ed Berkey, who is the engineer on the other end of our connection there with the Brookings, for making it possible to have this good, high-quality connection with Washington. Focus 580, this program is made possible in part by a grant from Buddywork Associates, offering professional licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Buddywork Associates offers 4 area locations, including one on the lower level of the Illini Union at the Oasis. And that is it for us here on Focus 580, but we want you to stay tuned. There's much more in the way of news, features, weather, sports, a lot of other things coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host for the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we'll talk about the garden in late summer. Our guests will be Diane Noland and Chuck Voigt. Both of them are with the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences at the University of Illinois. Let's take a look at commodity prices now and how those contracts are faring in Kansas City and in Chicago, and we'll take a look at the outside markets as well. We begin in Kansas City with the September wheat contract trading at 837, down 28 and three quarters. December 862, down 26. September wheat in Chicago trading at 803, down 27 and a half. December 825, down 29 and a half. September corn 572 and three quarters, down 2 and a half. December 592, down 2. March 610, down 3 and a half. May 622 and a quarter, down 3 and three quarters. September soybeans 1339, up 1 and a half. November 1340, down 4 and a half. January 1368 and a half, up 6 and a half. March 1376, up 1 quarter. September meal 367 even, that down 20. September oil 53.90, down 2. At the Merck in Chicago, August live cattle, $100.62.5, down 107.5. October, 103.67.5, down 207.5. August feeder cattle, 112.92.5, down 10. September, 111.20, down 95. And October lean hogs, down $3.